Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Hello and welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio, which comes to you to connect politics and finance, humanity and world peace, and the arts in a way that encourages all to think for themselves so the best political and life choices are made by all. With artistic overtones, the Reasonable Voice is an advocate for a peaceful and prosperous world filled with creativity and political unity. And I am very pleased today that our very first Blog Talk Radio guest is back with us today with new developments in her movie career, and we're going to talk about that and the kind of social service she's using film to address. This is Cassidy McMillan. Cassidy, how are you?
I'm doing great, Marcello. Thank you for having me back on your show.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you back. It was courageous of you to be the first, and now you're returning, I know, with news. But let's tell everyone a bit about you. Cassidy is the producer, director, writer of Bullies and Friends. And she's about to launch a crowdfunding campaign to cover the costs of the post-production and pre-distribution for the worldwide release of Bullies and Friends. She has a global distribution company, which is really quite an accomplishment for an independent filmmaker, but it doesn't come, you know, free. The distributor shows up and all your troubles are over. There are expenses and FCC requirements and production costs, and we're going to talk about those and as well as, of course, the subject matter, the very important subject matter of Bullies and Friends. So, this documentary film, Cassidy McMillan herself is an award-winning filmmaker and actress, a member of Screen Actors Guild, AFTRA, all those good things, many shows in film and television, American Movie Classics, Discovery Channel, 20th Century Fox, NBC, I mean, she's done it all. But today, let's talk about what I think it wouldn't be too much of an oversimplification to say, Cassidy, has become your chosen life's mission, at least for now, and that's trying to find solutions via your film talent and your team to bullying in schools, the bullying of kids and parents and communities. Is that fair to say is a mission for you now?
Definitely. I'm a very strong advocate for the cause, which is why I made the film. I made the film in the hopes of preventing another boy or girl from taking their life due to bullying. And it has become a worldwide epidemic.
Mm.
And, like, according to the Centers for Disease Control, bullying among school-aged children is a major public health problem.
Wow.
And as we know, every year more and more children are committing suicide due to bullying. And also the Centers for Disease Control has stated that suicide is the third leading cause of death among children. And one child is too many, and that's why I made the film, because the film does offer solutions to bullying, to schools, to parents, to kids. And through my research and work at schools across North America, both in Canada and the United States, just from the information I've learned, working with so many kids, thousands of students, that now, it turns out that, yes, now I'm called upon as an expert in the field, and it's just an important cause.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think certain issues seem so large that we feel you know, society kind of feels, well, we just can't address it, we can't get a handle on it because mm-hmm. it's so large. And through the work of film, I think a large difference can be made, because one can tell a story maybe through the eyes of one individual or a few individuals mm-hmm. and kind of bring that issue down to a smaller scope that then people can understand better, relate to, and see more solutions more clearly.
And certainly Bullies and Friends puts a face on it. We've been brought up thinking, bullying is something you just have to go through in school, get over it, man up, or whatever. But when you put a face on it, and that face is no longer alive because of bullying, people have got to pay attention. And film, as you say, is certainly a powerful medium for getting the message across. I guess I should mention, in addition to all of your speaking engagements and showcasing the film in schools and communities, you were also on the board of directors for the organization against bullying called National Voices for Equality, Education, and Enlightenment. That's correct, yes?
Yes, correct. They're an organization in Miami, and they work to address bullying in schools, and I'm honored to be on their board of directors. It's a volunteer position. I donate my time and work, and it's a very worthy organization, and they literally try to put boots on the ground, as it were, mm-hmm. in schools to do work on bullying and have youth ambassadors. And so I'm glad that myself and my film can work with the organization there, like I said, because they do a really great work. They're a nonprofit organization, and I'm glad to be on their board.
Now, I mentioned earlier that you've secured worldwide distribution with a distribution company, which is a major accomplishment and not all that usual for an independent film. But in the meantime, how have you been paying for the productions of Bullies and Friends, if it's not too personal a question?
No, that's a great question. And I financed the film by actually when I was getting ready to begin filming, my mother was diagnosed with a terminal illness. Mm. And so production was halted. And obviously, and I went to be with her, and I took care of her, and she had passed away. Then she passed away, mm-hmm. and the house belonged to both me and my mom, and she knew about the film project, and she knew of its importance, and she was a volunteer and advocate for different causes, and I had a choice to make. I needed to make this film, and there just wouldn't have been time or the possibility to crowdfund to raise enough money to make the film, and I just felt the cause was too important. So I sold my house, which was fully paid off, mortgage free, to make the film, as well as a small business loan, but really, it was the money from the sale of my house, and so that's what I used to make the film. So,
wow.
You know, but yeah, I mean, some people have said, you know, are you crazy to have done that? But I just think in this world, some issues are too important, and
yes.
You can't put a price on the life of a child. And at some of the school showings where we previewed certain segments of the film, I have had several kids come up to me and in different ways of saying it have told me that, you know, they were this close to killing themselves because of bullying, but after seeing the film, they saw the devastation that their suicide would cause. They realized suicide was not the answer and that they would seek help instead. And so I already know that it's been worth it. But it definitely has been a long journey. But I think sometimes in this world, you just have to make an effort and take a stand against something in order to make a difference.
You know, you I think you said earlier that this has become a global epidemic, that is bullying. And I know we hear from time to time about a child dying in connection to being bullied. But I don't think, as a society, I don't think we really have an idea or grasp the enormity of the problem. So much so that there's a term for it, which I first heard from you in our first interview, and that's bullicide. I know the film pushes for solutions, but children are committing suicide because of bullying so much that we have coined a word to describe it, bullicide? Is that where we are?
That is the sad reality of it. Yes, bullicide, that's exactly it. It's when someone takes their life due to being bullied. And obviously that's horrible.
Yeah, gee.
And especially, you know, in today's environment, especially with social media and the internet, bullying really, first of all, is harassment. And many times it does cross over the border into criminal harassment.
Mm-hmm.
And with social media, kids are being just driven to suicide with these threats and harassment 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's not like they just go to school and get harassed, which would be awful enough, but, you know, on their way home, at home, wherever they are, you know, people are harassing them through Facebook, Twitter, their email, text messages. It's you know, on the website Ask FM and all of these other things going on with kids. And so as adults, I mean, we have to view it as, what if as an adult you go to work and you get harassed and bullied and people say, oh, you should kill yourself and you're worthless or we're going to kill you, you should just die. And then you go home and you open up your emails and there's just more of that over and over and insults and everything else. In fact, recently with the NFL bullying scandal that came out with the Miami Dolphins, their player, Jonathan Martin, I mean, here you have, right, this huge football player, an adult, and he said he was thinking of committing suicide due to the harassment / bullying he was receiving.
My goodness. Well, let's talk specifically about the plot of the film. What is the film about? I know it tells, I know you have a bigger story to tell, but what is the film plot line? Bullies and Friends.
Right. In Bullies and Friends, we focus on the true story of a 14-year-old girl. Her name was Dawn Marie, and she was bullied and threatened with death by three girls at her school. So they're also threatening to kill her. And the bullying became so intense that she felt her only way out was to take her own life. So she just, it was horrible, obviously. She ended up committing suicide by, she hung herself in her bedroom with her dog's leash.
Oh my goodness.
And in her suicide note, she named these three girls at her school.
Who had bullied her?
Yeah, right, exactly. And so she named them in the note, and the incident led to an investigation by a regional prosecutor, and it led to the precedent-setting court case in North America because it was the first time that teens were brought to trial for bullying.
Wow.
And so that's the story we tell. I reached out to the family after I had heard about the story, and they wanted to tell their story. I wouldn't have made the film without the family wanting to. And the mom really wanted to get the story out there. I had seen her on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and, you know, she's already starting to speak out on it. And I knew through the work of film that we could get this message out to a larger audience. Like, so I was just so horrified that I felt compelled to take action. And as a filmmaker who works on causes, it just, you know, occurred to me that a film could really get that story out there. Like I said, really put out that huge issue of bullying, but told through this one family story.
Yes.
And through the eyes of this one girl and her best friend and her brother. Her younger brother, unfortunately, was the one to discover his sister in her room. He went to go get her for dinner. Imagine that. And instead,
found her hanging.
She wasn't with him anymore, yeah. So,
and she was 14.
14 years old, yeah.
Oh, God. What, you know, it's... It's depressing. It's sad. It's and as a definer of our society, it's really it's just mind-boggling. But how does one? Because I know your goal is to tell the story, to make us aware, to open our eyes, bucket of cold water in the face, if you will. This is going on far more often than you think. But how you go further than that? After you show us the problem, you offer solutions. What sort of solutions to bullying can we expect to see in Bullies and Friends?
Right. One of the really remarkable things in the film is that we have the main teen girl who was brought to trial for bullying. She's in the film. She wanted to tell her story.
Wow.
She's never really shared her story publicly like that before or since. And through her own words, through her interview, throughout the film's about 90 minutes in length, and throughout the film we come back to her for her comments and thoughts on the matter. And really it's through her story as well that teens are deeply affected by her interview, where at the beginning of the film they really want to hate her because they feel, oh, she helped cause the death of this girl. But by the end of the film, you do feel some sadness for her, and you also kind of see, you know, she took a brave step in being in the film.
Yes.
She could have not been in it. One of the other girls was supposed to, and then, you know, jump ship. But this girl was very brave, and she offers solutions to kids because she tells them directly how you can not bully people, what you should do instead, how you can better communicate. And while with her individual situation, she was acquitted by the judge due to the fact that the judge said that this particular girl tried to calm the situation down a little bit before Dawn Ray killed herself.
Mm.
But this girl is actually the one that, from all appearances, seems to feel the most guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something she'll carry with her. So we have that. Also in the film, we have the exclusive interview with the judge who presided over and handed down the precedent-setting ruling in this landmark court case. And the judge refused, and we're really just so honored to have her in the film because she refused all other media interviews from across the globe. I mean, one has to understand this case was highly controversial, and there were press from many different countries there, and she turned down all media interviews, and in fact initially turned down our request through a law clerk, just sort of out of hand. And then when, you know, I followed up more with them, and then they saw what we were doing when we were filming in the town, and word got out and newspaper articles about us filming there. And so from that they reached out and said, yes, actually the judge will sit down with you, and just her interview is fantastic, and she really gives advice to kids, and she actually talks about a bullying incident that she saw as a child and what she did to intervene, and also just really gives perspective on the court case and all of that. And it was an honor to sit down with her in her chambers there at the courthouse, and she gives great information, you know, to educators as well as, you know, people in the legal system and all that can sort of look at that as a case study of that case. And in addition to that, we have top educational experts. We're totally honored to have Dr. Michelle Borba in the film, best-selling author of 23 books and a regular contributor on the Today Show, and ABC The View, Dateline NBC, on and on, the Katie Kirk Show. And they were really, in, you know, a doctor herself, so a psychologist, so we're really honored to have Dr. Michelle Blovet in the film, and she presents solutions to both kids and parents, and then also educators in schools as far as how we can work to prevent bullying and relational aggression and peer cruelty. So we have that in the film. And then also the brother, as we mentioned, who is the one to find his sister in her bedroom, and just so brave. And again, he's never before since spoken publicly. And we told him, you know, you absolutely do not have to do this. You don't have to be in the film. And he was like, no, I want to get the story out there. And really that day of filming was quite emotional.
Wow, yes. I can imagine.
His mom felt, too, that it was a help. And so, again, just seeing his story and his words was deeply affecting. And then also the best friend of Dawn Marie, and she gives perspective onto what was happening, what went on with these teen girls, what the bullying involved, and, again, her thoughts for a solution. So the solutions really come organically in the film, and I think that's why it's having such a huge impact.
Yes.
And at focus group screenings across the U.S., when schools were contacting me saying, please come out and show the film, and I was like, well, you know, we're still in post-production or maybe still filming. And they were like, well, just bring whatever you have, and, you know, if you can come speak. And so I took that as a huge opportunity where I was able to go across the U.S. and do, you know, focus group screenings of certain segments of the film and get... I handed out questionnaires to them so I could get their feedback, specific feedback about what they related to the most, who they identified with in the film, their thoughts on bullying, what has happened to them regarding bullying, and it just was truly eye-opening. And really, so this film was also kind of put together by kids and educators throughout the country, you know, to where... You know, maybe got it down to the most effective 90 minutes that I felt were the most compelling and solution-oriented, but through, like I said, an organic way, not like instructional or something. So it's deeply resonating with kids, and that's what we wanted to do.
All right. We're going to take a break, everyone. I'm talking to Cassidy McMillan, who is herself an award-winning actress, but she is the producer, director, writer of the documentary film Bullies and Friends, full of true stories, and the cast is in actual participants of the events that are described in the documentary, and the solutions are in the comments, responses of students and educators across the country. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Cassidy McMillan.
Hey, yo, look, this is Earth Ethereal. Verses are lyrical. Some people research empirical data to find the meaning to the matter. We all just want meaning and to matter. Hey, yo, look, this is Earth Ethereal. Rebirth and spiritual. Some people seek in their churches for miracles to find the meaning to these matters. We all just want meaning and to matter. She knows the secret laws of attraction, cause and reaction, and she wears rabbit paws as a fashion. She's into herbs and nature, supernatural, superstitious, super religious. What other people see as crazy, she just sees as true to her convictions. A combination of psychology and psychics, astrology and cosmopolitan advice tips. She finds God in everything. She's looking for meaning. The stars. A professor, a naturalist, a humanitarian. No time for family. He's preoccupied with his occupation at the planetary. Science and religion have no business together. The universe is governed by laws, not by a god who controls the weather. And there's no laws of secret attraction. Everything has an opposite and equal reaction. He doesn't find God in anything, but he's looking for meaning. The stars.
Welcome back to The Reasonable Voices, Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando. My guest today, Cassidy McMillan. In addition to all of the educational and emotional issues connected with the truth in Bullies and Friends documentary film, produced and directed and written by Cassidy McMillan, there are pragmatic and financial issues as well. Because you are doing the right thing doesn't mean it comes free to you. We heard in our first segment how Cassidy sold her home after her mother's death to finance much of what she's doing. And now, as I've said, it's not easy to get a distributor. It's certainly for an independent filmmaker. She's got a distributor who's ready, standing by to go global with this message in Bullies and Friends. But there are costs, and let's talk about, so people sort of understand. You're about to do a crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo. Everybody know what Indiegogo is? You can find it at, easy enough, www.indie, as in indie film, indiegogo.com. What is what is it for those who don't know, and crowdfunding platform?
Right. Indiegogo.com is a global crowdfunding website where people can donate to causes, organizations that they believe in, projects that they believe in, and each project gives out perks or gifts, as it were, for each donation level. And people can donate anywhere from a dollar up to the sky is the limit. Right, so projects go there to just kind of have a platform to put their campaign out there, and there's all kind of different categories, and so we are obviously in the film category, and so that's where we're going to raise the needed and required funds according to all the contractual obligations for us to be able to deliver the film to the distributor, because as you mentioned, it's not like the distributor shows up at your door and says, here's a check.
Yes.
In fact, they don't give you anything. You actually have to provide many things to them to distribute the film, and that comes at a high cost. As you know, like in this case, you know, over six figures, and so we need to raise about $300,000 to meet all the requirements to finalize the post-production and get it set with the pre-distribution requirement. But yes, Indiegogo gives a great platform for that, and so that they secure all the donations. And really, as long as anyone has either a PayPal account or a credit card, as I said, they can donate anywhere from a dollar on up, and every dollar makes a huge difference in paying for all the costs to get the film to the distributor.
Now, depending on, just so people know, there is a cost in donating using PayPal, credit card companies, because they take or charge a fee, which takes away from, it's automatically deducted from the campaign total. Is there a way, I mean, is that just a fact of life? There's no way of getting around that, or what are your thoughts?
Right.
It's just
right.
The way it is.
It's just the way it is, and so we do have to factor that into the campaign as well, that anywhere, I think, like you saw, the percentage is anywhere from like 10% maybe to 20% is taken, you know, whether through Indiegogo fee for, you know, providing the platform and securing the payment method, or PayPal themselves, or the credit card companies, you know, they all do take a fee. I mean, obviously, another way around that is, you know, if a private donator or something wants to, you know, write a check to the film or anything else, or, you know, maybe come to us with a business proposal or something, we'll look into that. But mainly through donations, you know, I think this way, so people can see they can get gift perks for their donation, you know, whether it's the official film crew T-shirt or be among the first to receive the DVD when the film was released. Mm-hmm. Up to, we have amazing perks at higher donation levels where people, for certain donation amount, can be listed as an associate producer of this film slated for worldwide release, as well as co-executive producer listing for their donation. So, you know, we really try to pull out the stops as far as, you know, as much as we could offer people to give them an incentive to donate beyond, you know, we hope their main incentive would be, because this film can, as people have said to us, you know, both journalists and schools and parents and kids have said to us, this film can save lives and potentially maybe has already at some of the early segment screenings. So, like I said, we hope that's people's main incentive, because our film's cause is bullying and bullying-side prevention. But beyond that, we put out there, you know, as much as we can give back to people to get them to want to donate to this film and its causes.
Yes, excellent. I know there, from my own experience, there are tremendous costs involved in marketing costs and they're required costs. Even the FCC has certain requirements that have to be paid, and of course the production editing, production office. The things we pay in life, only more expensive. Utilities, internet costs, equipment, staffing. I mean, all the things we're used to when we go to an office to work or even home, but we don't think of them always when we look at the arts, film or otherwise. That, you know, those costs are there to make a movie, a documentary, as well, and they have to be paid somehow. And this certainly has a huge mission, goal to accomplish, to wake us up and help us to figure out how to treat each other better. What about you mentioned to me on the phone the other day about being an ambassador. What is that?
Right. And you, Marcello, are one of our film's official ambassadors. And with that, we have several key ambassadors that work to share the word of our film, you know, spread the news about it and be our representatives in the press and media and out in the public. Those people who have been supportive of this film, as you have, and the film's causes. And so we just want to show our support of all of you and making you all our official film ambassadors to go out there and help get the word out about the film and what's going on with it and like I said, in the film's causes. So we appreciate you being one of our film ambassadors and for being so supportive of this film all along its journey.
Well, I have to say I'm honored at that absolutely honored. We now have you and I talking on, off and on and on and off air for a few years, and certainly every time I talk to you, more has been accomplished, and the road forward has certainly been plowed. But there's just so much. It's not that they keep moving the goalpost, but it's certainly it must feel like that sometimes.
Sometimes it does, you know. I mean, there was a time when I thought, you know, would we get distribution? I mean, first you start out like people want to see this film, and
yes,
then they wanted to see it in droves. You know, we have requests from, I don't even know at this point, over 15 countries and stuff for it. And that's without really any large publicity at all, just word of mouth. And, right, and then distribution. And as you know, you're an accomplished filmmaker and actor yourself. That, yes, only a small percentage of films, I read somewhere in a recent article, less than 10% of independent films get selected for distribution.
Yes.
So, I mean, I'm deeply grateful for that. And, but then again, you know, come the cost, like you said, and as most people, you know, in the film industry know, you know, whether you're talking about E&O insurance, other insurance, you know, all those things total $14,000 plus, the different post-production and getting it ready for all the multi-platforms and distribution, whether that's video on demand, Xbox, iTunes, DVD, all of that. And that itself, you know, anywhere from 150,000 and up, and the film crew and template design and, you know, website, tech designers, domains, all that. And it's just enormous. Closed captioning, you know, the FCC regulations, you know, can go up to $15,000-$20,000 in itself. And like I said, just paying for the production office and all the costs to oversee that and staffing and film editors. And so it's rather enormous, but like I said, we, you know, I'm so thankful I've been able to get this film this far and secure worldwide distribution for this feature documentary. And so, yeah, this is our final stand. This is it. This is our final hurdle we need to raise these funds. So it's an all-or-nothing campaign, and that if we don't raise the funds, the film can't be released. You know, I've taken it as far as I can, and then I'm sort of turning it over to the public. You know, so for when we said we want to help, you know, with bullying, we want to help this film, what can we do? And so, you know, this is a fantastic opportunity for everyone across the globe, anywhere, can get involved, log on to Indiegogo.com in the film category, find us, Bullies and Friends, and we're there, and they can donate to the film.
Now, this has a bit of a time frame, if I'm correct. The global crowdfunding campaign is for 2 months on Indiegogo.com. So we're in that time frame, and when does that get officially launched, or are we in it already?
Right. Yes. Yeah. We're just in it now. So we're just beginning. So so it'll be a 2 month campaign, and the dates and all that are on the campaign page site, as well as we also have an 8 minute short film, as it were, that we made the campaign video, but it's an 8 minute video or a short film, as you want to call it, that fully also explains about the film, and we have a couple of clips from the film in there from the film's trailer, and so the 8 minute video fully explains it as well as the whole campaign page also.
And you've got Facebook, website, Twitter, information everywhere. When will the 8 minute film be made public? Is that happening soon?
Right. Yes, that's on the Indiegogo page for the crowdfunding campaign.
Okay.
So it's right there for the campaign.
Okay. Excellent. Let's talk about, before we run out of time, you and I get to talking, and there is so much to talk about, but I don't want to leave before we really spell out some important information for finding the film and for being a part of this incredible work. So the Facebook page, Bullies and Friends page, we'll share here. I'll go to www.facebook.com/bulliesandfriendsfilm. And the Bullies and Films, Bullies and Friends website, Cassidy?
Is www.bulliesandfriends.com.
Okay. And do you wish to give your personal website?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. It's CassidyMcMillan.com. So CassidyMcMillan.com.
Okay. And Twitter's at Bullies Friends. At Bullies N Friends. Okay.
Right, because, yeah, since Twitter has that limit on characters you can use, so it's Bullies and then the letter N. And then Friends, so Bullies and Friends on Twitter. And then I'm on Twitter at CassidyMCM.
Now, what about email? Do you take email if people have questions or ideas or want to know where to send a check?
Absolutely. It's info@bulliesandfriends.com. So again, info, at bulliesandfriends.com.
Okay, all right. I hope everyone got that, because I wanted to make certain we know how to get a hold of you. As you say, you're trying to raise $300,000 or more. Was that the figure you gave? And it's not a lot of money, you know,
no.
As films go, but certainly as a solo with team independent filmmakers, it's something one is expected to need to turn to the public at some point, and you've done your part, and now I hope we as members of the public will do ours. I mean, you know, the itemized lists of costs. And it, you know, $149,000 for this, $14,000 for that, licensing $12,000. It accumulates $91,000 for video production and keeping up, you know, 40 hours of film footage. It's not an inexpensive thing. And when you do it for a worthy cause, you just hope that people will see its value. And we'll help finance it. And perhaps before we go, we really have run out of time. But what is that? You know, people. You've already mentioned the kind of incentives. But what's the one that you think, as we go, might leave the public with an impression, that one incentive that, wow, gee gosh, let me do the right thing. Let me donate some money, and guess what I'll get. What would you say is that number one incentive?
Well, the number one thing I hope is that their incentive would be that they can help save kids' lives through this film.
Exactly.
So that's really my number one hope, beyond the gift that we've offered them, because you can't put a price on the gift of life.
And to close, and I knew you would say that, and that's why I asked it, because I always remember the story, I think, of an 8-year-old, which brings up the point of the age range of students and schools that are seeing at least portions of this movie is quite broad. And I think I remember a story, it was an 8th grader or an 8-year-old, I can't remember which, but she saw the movie with her father at her older sibling's school, and once she saw the movie, she wanted the movie to, she asked her dad to have you bring the movie to her elementary school. Am I remembering correctly?
Correct, yes. It was an 8-year-old little girl, and yes, she saw the film at a screening, and yes, so she asked her mom and dad, who were both there. She was like, you know, let's show the film at my school. I want to show it my film. You know, this film, I want to show this film at my school. It can really make a difference, because
yes,
that's like what's going on at my school. So there are definite things that she related to or had seen going on. And like I said, yeah, I mean, here she was 8 years old. So.
Exactly. And I think we're going to end on that point. And that is, don't think your child, regardless of age and or football player size, don't think they are immune to bullying. This is a worldwide situation. It is not just schoolyard calling names. It's cyberspace. It doesn't leave you alone in a 21st century of devices in our hands that we're constantly looking at. Somebody you know is looking at a device that's demeaning that it can push them to commit suicide, or as it is now so prevalently called, bullycide. I'm going to stop with that, but I want to just make that point that we are looking at something that helps, and I hope you will help Cassidy McMillan reach the goal line with Bullies and Friends, her documentary film. Our guest today has been Cassidy McMillan, producer, writer, director of Bullies and Friends, the documentary, and we're going to say goodbye to her and wish her all the best, but don't go away. We will be back for a panel discussion. The Reasonable Voices in the studio with me today are technical support, creative catalyst, and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins with Michelle Obama. I should be so lucky. With Michelle Opperman and Danielle Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. Thank you for joining us today, and don't go away. We've finished our conversation with Cassidy McMillan for now. We will be talking to her again sometime in the future, I'm sure. But come back, stay with us, and our panel is going to have a great discussion about issues such as this. I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. Thank you so very much, Cassidy, for being on the show today, and I wish you all the very best.
Thank you, Marcello. Thank you.
Bye now.
Please visit the Indiegogo campaign for the critically acclaimed feature documentary film Bullies and Friends at www.indiegogo.com/projects/bulliesandfriendsfeaturedocumentaryfilm and donate to stop bullying today.
We all want to know who we are. If you're an astronomer, an astrologer, you're looking for meaning in the stars. If you're looking through a telescope or looking at a horoscope, you're looking for meaning in the stars. If you're looking at the supernova or the supernatural, you're looking for meaning in the stars. If you're looking at the logical or the mythological, you're looking for meaning in the stars. If you're studying physics or going to psychics, you're looking for meaning in the stars. If you're a scientist or a Scientologist, you're looking for meaning in the stars. Extraterrestrial. If you're trying to go to heaven or just trying to figure out how the heavens go, you're looking for meaning in the stars. If you research the molecular, church or secular, doubt. If you flirt and you're checking her out, we're all just looking for the meaning to the matter. We all just want meaning and to matter.
The Reasonable Voices in the studio with me today are technical support, creative catalyst, and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Opperman and Danielle Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. Thank you for coming back and sticking with us and sharing our thoughts and feelings and programs with your friends, both online and off. I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, and what about sustainability, artistic sustainability? How many artists out there? You know, I'll start this off with a quick story. So what else is new? Everybody. Two quick stories, but they're part of the same thing. All my life, I was lucky, I guess, in the sense that in the sixth grade, I knew what I wanted to be. And that didn't change until I was long after the sixth grade. But I started out wanting to be a director and an actor and a singer in that order. And that's, you know, and school teachers were very supportive and whatever until, I guess, high school. And then it was time to do this thing. And then everybody for years said, say it with me, everyone. When are you going to get a real job? And we've all heard that. And I heard it for decades. And until, literally, I was on national television, my parents and others did not stop saying, when are you going to get a real job? So, and they were very supportive, but, you know, you go on TV, hey, okay. Now, the second story, I can't remember now, but that's probably good enough to open the discussion. If I sound a little wired this morning on the show, I haven't eaten today, and I'm drinking a lot of black coffee, but I'm happy and I'm upbeat, especially for the people here, and we're talking about the arts. So, sustainability is a big subject. In Charlottesville, in Virginia, in America. And, oh, I know what the other story was. Way back when the Grand food store, was it a food store? The Grand, they don't know, they're all young here. The Grand food store, I think it was a food store, grocery store, closed, and all those people lost their jobs. My best friend and I from college, he's a conductor, and he too has been fortunate enough, as I have been, to always pursue our career successfully. He said, you know, all those people who kept telling us we should get real jobs, and now the sad thing, and we weren't mocking in any way, but the sad truth was we knew people. That's what it was, Grand, because I happened to be dating the general manager of the Grand grocery store, and that's how I knew the inside story. But here these people who had done what everyone said, gone out and got the 9-to-5, worked their tails off just so they might have a piece of their dream on the weekend or a cocktail party on Friday night, and now that was no longer secure, and that was way back before my New York years, and here we are now in economic times that we have to go. Maybe the 9-to-5 is just not what it used to be, and maybe we're being forced to pursue our dreams.
Well, as I was leaving the house today, I saw this commercial that I've seen a few times now, where New York is offering tax-free for 10 years people who want to move there and start a business.
Oh my God! New York City or New York?
New York City.
Holy smoke!
And there's certain zones that they have designated where you don't have to pay taxes. And I was like, that's incredible. 10 years of tax-free. They said if you have something innovative, something that's going to make jobs, we want it here. Yeah. And that's what you're saying. As I was watching the commercial, like people are now getting it. Like,
yeah.
The old way is over.
It's over.
There's no more of
get a real job.
The real jobs are you have to create a job.
Exactly.
Because the only things left is creativity, because the Industrial Revolution mindset is over now.
So how do you and I don't think we should be frightened by that. I think that's a kind of welcome thing, although I know people are going through hard times, and heck, I'm selling off real estate like crazy. So I do understand that, but at the same time, it kind of nudges us into being entrepreneurs or at the very least pursuing our dreams instead of, have something to fall back on. How many times have we heard that? Michelle?
Yeah, well, I think I think about this topic as it relates to Charlottesville, and there's a lot of local artists around here, and I think there's a lot of entrepreneur hype. There's a lot of startups and young minds wanting to have different companies, and I think that the question can sometimes be, what is going to allow somebody who has a lot of creativity, what's going to afford them the means to do what they hope to do? So thinking about like New York and the tax-free, that's a start. But I think that sometimes, because maybe the mindset for so many years is like, when are you going to get a real job? Mm-hmm. There can be less of a willingness, I think, to fund, mm-hmm. and especially if it gets to the arts. I mean, we're talking just like literary arts, creative, like visual art, poetry, all of that. I mean, a lot of times there's just this sense of that's extra.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But that's the very thing that is the core of creativity, which mm-hmm. creates the new jobs, which then fuels the market. Mm-hmm. So I think, I think Bernard could tell us a little bit about the bridge and what they're doing for artists here in Charlottesville, which would allow them to be funded, for the work that they do.
And the bridge is, just for those who don't know.
The Bridge is a nonprofit, I believe. I think they're nonprofit, but they are called the Bridge Progressive Arts Initiative, and it's recently been handed over to Matthew Slatz, the new director. So one project that they just did is called Community Supported Arts, which they based off of community supported agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas a farm would provide a box of produce and people would pay the farm, and then when your produce is ready, it's like, come pick up your produce. So they said, why don't we do that for art? And I don't know if they're the first ones to come up with it, but they're the first in Virginia to do it. So they took that model and they, had proposals go out and artists applied, like, what would you do to do something that links people in Charlottesville who may not normally buy art or be interested in art with artists?
Mm-hmm.
So it was out of 40 proposals, four of us were picked.
Mm.
And so then they paid us a stipend to do a project, and we each had to create 50 iterations of something. Uh-huh. So I did 50 little lunch pail containers that had a USB drive with a poem on it, and then some little cards that kind of gave the themes of these upcoming performances. And first, I'm actually doing today at 5. So all the people who paid for them, they're going to get to hear me perform for, private performance. And there's one girl, she did a insect book that she made. Another woman makes purses out of old book covers and she folds them over. Another guy, he creates 3D models on the computer, but then he prints it out and it actually does embroidery. So people got embroidered 3D models.
Oh, wow.
So basically Matthew, his whole idea was to really like, how can you get these artists and people who in the community don't really normally engage, like bring down the barriers, you know what I'm saying? And so it gives people a way to buy art, and at the same time gives artists a way to make art for them and not have to, like, as we're saying, work the 9-to-5 job and then go do something else, after the 9-to-5 job.
Well, and I think what's great about that, too, is that it's not just simply
like, I don't think there's an exchange happening there, you know, like, so it's not just as simply here's some money for your art because, you know, you don't usually make a lot from art. So here's like a sympathy money. You know what I'm saying? Not that there's anything wrong with somebody just, you know, being a patron to the arts, which is simply just giving money to the artist to make things. But in this case, there's like a real exchange. Like, people are putting in, you know, they're going to put in money to receive something for and receive that person's creation, you know. So I think there's a real sense of mercantile exchange happening, which I think the arts lends itself to. Mm-hmm. I mean, you start there, but you go to creating jobs. Mm-hmm. And then you're really actually, I mean, I think it all points to economic growth, actually. Mm-hmm. But I think that's really a good thing. It's, you know, you're actually creating goods that can be sold. And I think that's something that can be underestimated.
Mm-hmm. Well, all wealth is a result of creativity because all wealth is created. Therefore, without creativity, no wealth is created. What happens is the wealth that already exists is distributed. In a growing world where population is increasing in globalization, if new wealth is not created, then the wealth that already exists from prior creativity will be stretched thin. The standard of living will drop for all, and that can result in civil unrest. So creativity is very, very important. There has never been such a thing as a secure job. There have just been long periods of time in which the jobs that existed were not threatened by outside forces and therefore lasted longer, not because they were innately secure, but because of the nature of the environment that existed at the time. Since that went on for about 100 years, we came up with an idea that there was such thing as a secure job, and there was such thing as being able to have a plan, and there was such a thing as doing 9-to-5 and retiring, and etc. There's nothing wrong with a 9-to-5 format and a retirement format until the society becomes to think that that is secure, that is invincible, and also they start saying that that's real. Because what does one mean when they say real job? They mean secure. Because if I am picking up rocks, it's a job. What does the term real mean in that statement? It's not very clear. But we come to define as real what we are used to. And if we are used to most people doing this format of job, then we come to judge that which is not in line with that format is incorrect. Furthermore, an issue with getting society to understand the value of creativity is that you can't so clearly draw the link between Steve Jobs' calligraphy class and Apple. That relation is not something that I can quote-unquote prove. However, it is most certainly very, very real. Einstein said that the main reason he came up with the theory of special relativity that has had long-term ramifications for all technological advancement since he read the philosopher David Hume. Many people would think that's a waste of time. Einstein said he would have never come up with what he came up with had he not hung out in his book clubs with his friends and read philosophers. My point is that the arts and humanities are very, very important. I think we only think as a society in terms of creativity as painting. We don't see creativity as the engine that is behind all wealth creation because we don't see how it directly links with wealth creation, but it very much does because the people of who participate in art carry it around within them to all of the actions and activities and organizations and what have you that they participate in. But you have to believe in that. And also I would add that you could say, well, there's, you know, 50 people in the calligraphy class, one Steve Jobs, those 49 other people wasted their time in the calligraphy class. Well, you only need one Steve Jobs to do the calligraphy and create jobs for thousands of people. And it's worth having those other 49 who may not directly use it, although we can't say that for sure because we don't know what they end up doing with the total of their lives. That one person changes the world and thus makes it worth funding and appreciating that calligraphy class or whatever it may be for that one individual who makes the world a better place for all.
You know, I think the not terribly long ago I heard on NPR Science Now, Science Today, whatever the name of the show is, but their point was that many scientists got their ideas from books and from, and lately from movies.
Yes.
There was a scientist, a couple of scientists on who had seen movies that show all this. They were speaking specifically about the solar system and there being another one, two or three of them. And that they started to investigate scientifically this possibility because they'd seen so many sci-fi films. And they thought and said very often this stimulates because when a creator of art starts creating, it's imagination. Mm-hmm. And then the scientist looks at that imagination and wonders, I wonder if that could be true. And then they start to investigate. Okay, and so there's a real practical proof of what we're all saying, especially with what Daniel was saying. Michelle and Bernard, I know you know this too, this new thing you're doing at the Bridge, there's a connection with teaching people how to pitch their art? Is that something separate?
Well, it's not directly related to the Bridge, but something Daniel and I have been working on is called Pitchcraft, which is the idea of how do you integrate a creative mindset with the business mindset. And it's even funny we say that nowadays because they're both, I mean, people, just like you were saying about the scientist, the scientist is praised, something Daniel's, you know, the scientist is praised for his curiosity.
Yes.
But the artist is kind of not, like, oh, you're curious? Go play. You know? Right. The scientist is doing something real over here. But this idea that everybody is a pitch person. If you get up in front of somebody and you have to captivate them with an idea, what is the difference between a stand-up comedian and a business person who has to do that? Both people in their own right have to captivate your attention with their idea. And it's just the way that it's done is, you know, specific to that point of view. But if a comedian doesn't know what he's doing, obviously he's not going to make the audience laugh. And if a business person doesn't know what he's doing, obviously he's not going to get his idea across. So why can't both sides learn from one another?
Yeah.
Especially because everybody is human, so everybody wants to laugh. Everybody uses words, so why not bring in a poet? You know, everybody, to some degree, likes watching films or storytelling. Mm-hmm. So why can't all of these, you know, attributes that come with the package of being comedian, poet, actress work for a business person? Because otherwise, you're only speaking to, like, a particular part of somebody's brain. Here's my product, buy it. But you have to really, you know, the best commercials make you laugh and make you think a little bit and, you know, make you chuckle and walk away. It's like, maybe I don't want to buy that product, but I remember it. You know, if nothing else, you would remember it.
You know, this reminds me that when I taught acting for TV commercials in New York for many years, of course, first of all, there were actors who came. But as the word got around with how I was teaching it, all of a sudden my classes were half filled with attorneys. And with other disciplines, retired people looking for a second career. But I like that attorneys and others were coming, and I know there was another discipline, I can't remember, that were coming to study on-camera technique for making presentations. Oh, it was businessmen, that's what it was. It was corporate people and attorneys. Mm. But Michelle.
Oh, well, I was thinking about how, you know, a lot of businessmen actually do have their own sort of art form when it comes to negotiation, and they have their own ways of talking with their clients, and they're often very well, you know, very good at what they do because they make sales and they do what they need to do for their company. I think that, to the point, I mean, Bernard touched on it, Daniel said it before, but like the idea though that if you do the same thing for when it comes to like pitching an idea, like simply for the sake of like learning. I mean, we get it now with like TED, you know, we get like the TED Talks. We love how people present their ideas and it's become a very popular thing. But it's a kind of a question of like, it's something I've been thinking about a lot lately is how ideas are both the most valuable things and also they cost nothing. Like you could just overhear somebody say something brilliant that changes your life.
Yes.
That's invaluable. Yes. And yet, at the same time, they didn't make any money from that, from that ability to share it. I mean, I think that points to the fact that money isn't everything. You know, it's what allows us to solve problems, and it is part of the economy, and it's not a bad thing, but it's certainly not everything. You know, but I think that with this whole idea of pitchcraft. So there's the businessman; he does his pitches his own way. There's the comedian, the you know, the artist, the poet. But I think what's great about Pitchcraft and what I've heard about it, I haven't had the privilege of seeing it yet, but is that it takes the idea of how would a comedian portray his message? You know, like he also has some truth he has to say for the joke to make sense,
sure.
You know, and how does the, you know, how would a poet convey their message? And I think all of that can really help one understand how it is a performance in a sense, to really allow people to understand where you're coming from and really get it. So Pitchcraft is great to do that. It really kind of clearly shows a cross-disciplinary form of communication, really. So yeah,
and we'll be getting those videos up hopefully soon on cypherideas.com, cypherideas.com.
I was going to say, let us know where we can find this.
Yeah,
well, it seems to me there's a basic thing too that we're saying, and while it may seem to be an insurmountable mountain, we should say it, because saying it is the first step to climbing and surmounting it. And that is, we all of us to here today are saying the public at large needs to change or evolve their opinion of what is a real job and their opinion of the artists in that world, because all artists are entrepreneurs and all entrepreneurs are artists in one form or another. It's a creative process, and there is tremendous artistic creation that influences what we call the real job. The real job. Artists are part of the... artists are real.
Can I throw this in right quick? Well, it's funny that, you know, related to what Michelle is saying about art being portrayed as the extra, like, oh, well, that's nice, like, on the weekend, you want to do that. But why is it that every year at UVA, when they have the valedictory speeches,
yes,
and then they have the commencement address at the actual graduation ceremony, the valedictory speeches are the most liked because they have a celebrity or an athlete.
Yes,
last spring or
fall,
Stephen Colbert was
here. Yes, yes.
People came out in the rain rain site to see him.
Right.
And as soon as he was done talking, everybody was leaving. Right. You know, the kid got up and was like, well, I'm the class president. Everybody was like, okay, it's funny how people present this idea that this is more important than this, but then the actual tangible evidence shows what people adhere to.
Well, it's happiness, you know. I mean, I've sat around at wonderful times in my life. I have to and looked at all the things I had acquired, and my response to all of it was, yeah, but they're just things. To have someone at your side at the beginning and end of every day, or on a drive on the back roads, that's happiness. A poem that moves you, that's happiness. It's spiritual, and it's the artist who gives us that. It's any creative person, you know. Again, as I think Daniel said, it's not just a paintbrush in your hand. Art is ideas and imagination and creativity that leads to any number of things.
Well, what you just need is a return to the Renaissance man. I mean, Leibniz was doing tests on air pressure as he was turning around and writing the philosophy that he was doing. It's been about, I guess, 180 years that we've had this movement towards specialization and the idea that a person does one task. What we're actually calling for is simply a return to an older way of life, in a way which genius is understood as holistic rather than specialized knowledge. I don't think it's by chance that as we've come to create, in a way, an idol of security, that you have a focus on this kind of specialization. I think also one of the reasons everyone knows that they're supposed to say that money isn't everything, but we act as a society as if money is everything because we're afraid. So we're afraid of, well, what happens if Jimmy, you know, goes out and does painting, or what happens if Steve Jobs takes calligraphy? He could be getting extra credits, and then he's going to waste his potential and never be anyone who ever makes a difference. And what if he goes to India and goes on this bicycle? Oh my goodness, he's going to waste his life. You know, it's that idea of fear. John 4:18, I think, it says, the one who fears is not made perfect in love, because fear has to do with torment. So what we need is a more fearless society. And as a society becomes more fearless, it will return to a state of the quote-unquote Renaissance man, and also will be made perfect in love.
Well, or even feel the fear and do it anyway, which is, you know, the famous book. It's not that life isn't full of challenge, and fears, but the point is either you roll over and stay in bed or you get up and you do the best you can do.
Well, to add, there's a difference between the fear of I see a lion, therefore I'm going to run from it, which is just smart. It would be stupid not to run from the lion. And the fear of if I don't do this thing, then tomorrow something bad's going to happen. This, that kind of fear, the second, is a sort of faith. Mm-hmm. You believe in this dreaded thing. That's the sort of fear that we need to do away with and then direct the other kinds of fears toward our destiny.
Another thing is, you know, speaking of art, I like to take that A and turn it to appreciation. And I think, you know, a lot of class, you know, school used to at least have an art appreciation
class.
That's
right. I remember
that. Hey, you may not be an artist, but you should learn the process. And I think that has to do a lot with what we're saying, because I think it's hilarious when people say, well, you can't become an artist because that doesn't make money. Not realizing that that very attitude is why it does not make money. Like, if you yourself and other people would start to appreciate what art was, then you would actually go see it and pay for it, and money would be made. But people just say, oh, it doesn't make money. Yes, because you're not giving money to it. So there's the problem. You are part of the problem.
And to that, as much as, you know, with the talk of minimum wage, people don't have no problem with having some artist get up during an open mic and not make a dime, and we don't look at that as sort of a violation of human labor, which says a lot about what we value as a culture.
I was also thinking about art and, you know, the fact that it makes life beautiful, and it reminds me a lot of, like, cooking. And I don't know, I always think about things like the domestic work of life, because it's something that I care to do, and you know, making a space beautiful, like painting a room, or you know, picking certain colors or fonts, you know, that and cooking a good meal versus just like a 5-minute meal. You know, I think that all of those things have a lot of beauty, and they're such a, you know, a daily part of our experiences that, you know, it really does make a big difference. You know, when you are in a space and it feels like a home, you know what I mean, versus feeling just like a room. But I think, you know, that kind of that small example that maybe seems unimportant to me is a very important, you know, picture of something much bigger, which is the fact that somebody taking the time to do that, it means that they care, you know, and they care to make a place that a person wants to be in. And I think larger in life lately, I've been contemplating the evils of the world and just despairing. But I think something that makes me hopeful is that we all can make a difference. You know, when you make something beautiful, that's like choosing to be nice to my friend Bernard, you know, instead of being insulting to him, you know. So that seems like, well, how does that have to do with aesthetics and art? It's because it's creative, you know. It takes creativity to overcome sometimes your feelings, or overcome nothing, just doing nothing and doing something positive, you know, or instead of taking creation and going in a destructive direction, taking creativity in, going in a positive direction, and realizing that that has much more value, you know, than almost anything.
Well, I think we probably we've covered a lot and a lot to think about, and it still comes down to us. But respect the artists and respect the artist in you, because we are all creating something every moment with every thought and every feeling and every reaction. This has been The Reasonable Voice. In the studio today with me have been the technical support, creative catalyst, and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Opperman and Daniel Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose and recently engaged to be married. Thank you for joining us today and every day, and recommending us to your friends. I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping that you will become one of the reasonable voices heard around the world.
Thank you for continuing to listen, support, and share The Reasonable Voice with your friends. We are now accepting offers for your company or organization to advertise with us, and welcome new sponsors for The Reasonable Voice. To apply, please email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com.
Thank you for joining us today and every day, and recommending us to all your friends, both online and offline. And please download our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.